Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 298 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing our gastroenterology review series for the USMLE exams. Again, after all is said and done, this should be pretty comprehensive, right? So I've done three parts. So this is part four. Okay, so let's just jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about a 50-year-old guy and he presents with dysphagia and they tell you that, oh, they perform endoscopy and it reveals like a circle of well-demarcated tissue at the squamocolumnar junction of the esophagus? What should you be thinking about there? In fact, sometimes they can tell you that, oh, this guy has like intermittent dysphagia. What should you think about? I would really hope you're thinking about something called Schatzky's ring. Right? Schatzky's ring. So the thing is, for whatever bizarre reason, lots of med students actually struggle with identifying Schatzky's ring on an MBM exam. So the thing is, there are some key details, some key pieces of information that will tell you, oh yeah, this is Schatzky's ring, this is nothing else, right? So the thing is, they will tell you that the person has intermittent dysphagia. And of course, that's found in many other things, right? But they will usually give you EGD results, right? So like results of an esophagogastroduodenoscopy, right? So what will those EGDs usually tell you? Well, those EGDs will tell you that, oh, there's a circle of tissue, right? Around the squamocolumnar junction. I mean, there are many different kinds of Schatzky's ring, but that's beyond the scope of our discussion right now. So some of you may be like, okay, Divine, how do I differentiate that from Plummer-Vinson? The thing is, Plummer-Vinson, they have like extra tissue that's, you know, kind of lining the wall of the esophagus, but it doesn't make a complete circle around it. That's how you differentiate a Schatzky's ring from Plummer-Vinson. Plummer-Vinson is the extra tissue does not, like the esophageal web essentially, does not completely encircle the esophageal mucosa, right? But Schatzky's ring, it does, right? And again, Schatzky's ring, it's basically like extra esophageal mucosa with an extra muscle, right? That again can cause like a partial or a complete obstruction of the esophagus, right? And usually if you want to make the diagnosis, you typically will do like, you know, when a person presents with dysphagia, you know, it's usually a smart idea first to do some kind of barium swallow, right? You can actually diagnose a Schatzky's ring with a barium swallow, but you know, you don't stop there. The thing you usually do after that is to make sure that you perform an EGD, right? Again, that will help you confirm the diagnosis. Just make sure, again, that there's nothing weird going on like cancer, for example, right? So for the most part, many people that have Schatzky's ring, they're actually symptomatic. It's actually a relatively common condition in the population, believe it or not. So for these people, for the most part, we don't do anything for them, right? But when it becomes symptomatic, right, like many times, people tend to do esophageal dilation, right? They tend to do esophageal dilation. Although remember, whenever you dilate a person's esophagus, you're also taking like the time-honored risk of perforating the person's esophagus, right? And if you perforated a person's esophagus, the sad thing that could happen is, you know, they'll have like stuff from the outside world going into the mediastinum, and they can get into a lot of trouble pretty quickly. And remember, whenever you've perfed a person's esophagus, usually the smart play, if you're trying to make the diagnosis, is don't do barium swallow. Remember, barium is very bad for the mediastinum. So if you think that a person potentially has a connection between the esophagus and the mediastinum, then don't use barium. Use water-soluble contrast, right? Sometimes they call it gastrographin enema, right? So I know I just mentioned that, oh, you know, if you see a person that has dysphagia, they could also have Plummer-Vinson syndrome. Well, remember, Plummer-Vinson syndrome is essentially a triad, right? These people have iron deficiency anemia. They'll have esophageal webs. Remember, esophageal webs are almost like a Schatzky's ring. But the big difference is that that extra mucosal tissue does not make a complete circle around the esophagus, right? And then remember, these people also have like tongue problems, right? They can have like a beefy red tongue or whatever, right? Just kind of watch out for that. So again, your friends at the MBME, they're not going to say, oh, a patient presents with iron deficiency anemia, esophageal webs, and a beefy red tongue. No, that's ridiculous, right? They're not going to do that on an exam, right? So the thing they're going to do is they're going to talk about some patient, you know, it can be like an old female, you know, she presents with dysphagia. And then they can tell you that, oh, CBC with differential, you know, they give you all these labs. And you notice that, wow, this person's ferritin is low. this person's transferring is high, this person's transferring saturation is low, right? And the person has a high free erythrocyte protoporphyrin, right? If you see all those things, right, you see like anemia in the setting of dysphagia, then you really want to think about, especially like a microcytic anemia in the setting of dysphagia, then you want to think about Plummer-Vinson syndrome, right? So let's explain some of those iron labs, right? Again, I don't want to be giving you facts with no context, right? So remember, if a person has iron deficiency anemia, they're literally deficient in iron. If you're literally deficient in iron, think about it. It's going to be really hard for you to have much of any iron stores, right? And remember, your iron stores are represented by ferritin. So your ferritin is going to be low, right? Now, if your ferritin is low, then your TIBC is going to be high, right? Remember, TIBC stands for total iron binding capacity, right? You're literally, like, if you notice that you're deficient in something, right? So let's say you notice that, you know, God forbid, there's little money in the home. Well, you know that, okay, I need to go out and bind some money by working. If I need to flip burgers or whatever, I'll do that to get some money, right? So the thing that happens is, if ferritin is low, your body will be like, okay, dude, go out. It sends transferring out. Go and bind iron as much as you can. So your TIBC will go up, right? But again, remember, you're deficient in iron, right? So that transferring that you have going to scavenge iron is not going to be saturated with iron, right? So your transferring saturation is going to be low. Now, the part about the high free erythrocyte protoporphyrin, well, again, that should make sense. Remember, for you to make heme, heme is like the union from iron and protoporphyrin coming together, right? Iron and protoporphyrin, they come together and they get married and then they form heme, right? So the thing is, remember, for a marriage to happen, both people need to show up, right? You can't just have one person showing up and the other not showing up. If one person does not show up, then the other person will start building up, getting pissed off and all that stuff, right? So essentially, if protoporphyrin is showing up, but iron is not showing up, that protoporphyrin is going to keep building up, right? So the free erythrocyte protoporphyrin increases in a person that has iron deficiency anemia. Now, what if they give you a question about like a 55-year-old male? They tell you that, you know, he presents with dysphagia and, you know, they tell you that, oh, he has these episodes where he vomits or regurgitates the same food that he ate last, like the previous day. And then they tell you that, oh, he came into the clinic today because his wife had been saying that his breath smells really bad, right? The buzzword they'll use on an in-beam exam for that, like for bad breath, is halitosis, H-A-L-I-T-O-S-I-S, right? Halitosis. That's like the $50 word for bad breath, right? So, you know, if you see stuff like this, I really hope you're thinking about Zenker's diverticulum, right? I hope you're thinking about Zenker's diverticulum, right? So remember, Zenker's diverticulum is a diverticulum you have in the upper third of the esophagus, right? If you have a diverticulum in the middle third of the esophagus, that's a traction diverticulum, right? And then if you have a diverticulum in the lower third of the esophagus, that's an epiphrenic diverticulum, right? And people may be like, oh, Divine, how do I remember what is in the upper third, what is in the middle third, what is in the lower third? Well, let me give you a trick. The trick is to remember the telephone company ZTE, right? So upper, middle, lower third, ZTE. Z for Zenker's, T for traction, E for epiphrenic, right? That's a very nice way to keep that straight. Right, so Zenker's diverticulum, remember again, it's actually a false diverticulum, right? It's actually a false diverticulum. Contrast this with Meckel's diverticulum. Remember, that one is more in the right lower quadrant. Excuse me, there, right? So that one is in the right lower quadrant. That's actually a true diverticulum, right? So it includes all the layers of the GI mucosa, you know, mucosa, submucosa, and the muscularis externa, right? But Zenker's is a false diverticulum, right? So basically, it's like the mucosa and the submucosa alone that are involved. That's very high yield to know. It's just the mucosa and the submucosa alone that are involved, right? So the mucosa, submucosa at the junction, right, between like the esophagus and the pharynx, they herniate through a weakness in a muscle, right? This muscle is the cricopharyngeal muscle. Sometimes people call it the cricopharyngeous muscle. Right, and this, so in the cricopharyngeal muscle, there is a point of weakness. That weakness point is commonly known as Killian's, key, like, you know, kill and then IAN, right? Kill and IAN, right? So kill and IAN, K-I-L-L-I-A-N, it's a triangle, right? So again, that's Zenker's diverticulum. And again, how do you diagnose this stuff? You're gonna go ahead and do some kind of barium swallow, right? You're gonna see the diverticulum. After you do the barium swallow and see the diverticulum, your next step is to do a diverticulectomy. You go ahead and chop out the diverticulum and obviously repair the esophageal mucosa. Now, they will try to trick you into doing an EGD. This is actually one of those GI disorders where you don't do that esophageal gastroduodenoscopy. Because again, literally think about it. It's literally a point of weakness in the wall. Do you think it's a smart idea to start bringing a scope through that? What if the scope cuts through that, right? And then the person essentially perforates the diverticulum, right? That's going to be a huge problem, right? So typically on NBM exams, do not select EGD as a kind of diagnostic test you would want to employ in a person with Zenker's diverticulum, right? In fact, they can give you a question about a person that has Zenker's and they did an EGD, and then the person has altered mental status, really high fevers, powerful leukocytosis, and all that badness. If you see stuff like that, that's essentially them telling you that the esophagus was perforated in that procedure, right? Now, what if they give you a question about like a 45-year-old guy and they tell you that, you know, he has this chronic ongoing history of like really, really bad abdominal pain 2 to 3 hours after every meal, and his BMI is 31, right? So you see this person, the abdominal pain seems to come a long time after the person has eaten, you know, like 2 to 3 hours after the meal. If you see stuff like this, I would really, really hope that you're thinking about a duodenal ulcer, right? I really hope you're thinking about a duodenal ulcer, right? So what's the pathophysiology here? Well, remember, whenever you eat, your duodenum, remember your duodenum has these Brunner glands. So they're like, oh, okay, let's make base so that we can deal with this acid problem from the food coming from the stomach, right? But, and whenever you make that base, right, remember, base is very good for soothing ulcers, right? So, you know, right after these people eat, you know, they are making a ton of base. So it's soothing the ulcer. So the ulcer doesn't feel as bad, right? Well, like 2 to 3 hours after, you know, a meal, all the food has gone through the stomach. So those Brunner glands are like, okay, we don't need to make base anymore. And then guess what? That ulcer becomes exposed again. It starts hurting. So guess what? Because these people know that whenever they eat, they make base, ulcer symptoms reduce. They eat a ton. So these are people that will tend to have like a big BMI. Like this person has a BMI of 31. This person is clearly in the obese category, right? So this person has a duodenal ulcer, right? So what's the most common cause of duodenal ulcers? About 90% of them are caused by H. pylori, right? That's very high yield to know. The biggest risk factor is very high yield. The biggest risk factor for duodenal ulcer on NBM exams is H. pylori infection, right? Now, one thing that can happen with duodenal ulcers that I think is very high yield to know is, what if they give you a question about a person that has a duodenal ulcer, and then they tell you that, oh, the person suddenly starts having like hemoptysis, right? Bloody bowel movements, person becomes super hypotensive, person bleeds out and dies, right? And then they can say, oh, what is the most likely finding on autopsy? Or they can even ask you like, what's the most likely mechanism behind the person's symptoms? I want you to think about the person having the ulcer erode all the way down to the gastroduodenal artery, right? Eroding all the way down to the gastroduodenal artery. What do I mean by that? And again, maybe like, man, Devine, this is super weird. It's super weird, but it's super high yield to know for exams. I'll say that again. It's super weird, but it's super high yield to know for NBM exams. And to be honest with you, it's actually pretty high yield for people that are going into gastroenterology and people that are going into general surgery, right? This is something that actually does happen. To be honest with you, I'm almost certain I've seen this clinically, like right before my eyes, right? This thing is an absolute nightmare, right? But when people start bleeding like this, it's usually like pretty bad, right? And, you know, they die, right? This thing is actually like, it can actually kill, right? I believe I saw this like relatively early in my time as a physician, right? So why is it a gastroduodenal artery problem? Well, the thing is, if you have a duodenal ulcer, remember the gastroduodenal artery supplies the ultimately, let's say, like the greater curvature of the stomach, right? So because it supplies the greater curvature of the stomach, right, it also actually, you know, supplies some parts of the duodenum, right? So the thing that can happen is, if you have an ulcer that erodes, remember, an ulcer, right, kind of starts in the mucosal surface, but if it keeps eroding mucosa all the way to the submucosa and impacts those blood vessels, well, the thing is, you can, those blood vessels can blow out, right? And then the person can bleed. And these bleeds are very life-threatening. I'm telling you, these bleeds, they are very life-threatening. If you see them in the real world, like a person bleeding from the GDA, from the gastroduodenal artery, it's one of those things you can never really forget. It's pretty sudden, but it's pretty grotesque when it happens. Like, blood coming out from the person's mouth in droves, right? Just something you want to be aware of for exams, right? And also clinically, right? So make sure you know that association with duodenal ulcers, right? That's something that your friends at the MBME love to test. But I guess since I'm talking about the gastroduodenal artery, what's another weird thing your friends at the MBME love to throw in with the gastroduodenal artery? It's actually this whole concept of people having like gastroduodenal hematomas after starting like an anticoagulant, right? So they'll give you a question about a person that, you know, maybe the person has like some disease, you know, like, I don't know, like AFib or whatever, where they need to be placed on some kind of anticoagulation, you know, long term. And then they tell you that, you know, after the person was started on this anticoagulant, like warfarin, heparin, whatever, the person starts complaining of this non-specific abdominal pain. And then sometimes they can be nice and say, oh, the person is having hemoptysis, bloody bowel movements. But many times, the smart thing that they do, you know, being your friends at the MBME, is they would give you that the person's hemoglobin has been dropping over time, right? So they will tell you that, oh, you know, when the warfarin was started, the person's hemoglobin was like 13 grams per deciliter, right? And then you notice that, man, it's like 2 weeks later, this person's hemoglobin is like 6 grams per deciliter, and the person is having like abdominal pain. If you see that, I really, really want you to think about some kind of duodenal hematoma, right? Like a gastroduodenal artery hematoma, right? Again, it's one of those high yield things you need to keep at the back of your mind. It has that temporal association on MBME exams with a person recently starting on anticoagulant therapy. And remember that also initiating an anticoagulant, right, it can cause hematomas in other structures, right? So what are these other hematomas that your friends at the MBME love to go after? They love to go after these rectus sheath hematomas, right? A rectus sheath hematoma is absolutely something that you could see on an MBME exam in a person that has that, you know, again, just recently started taking some kind of anticoagulation. Another thing you may actually see on an MBME is these people, they may tell you that, oh, a person was just recently started on some kind of anticoagulation. And then you notice that, man, these people are having like saddle anesthesia, right? They're having like low back pain, things of that nature. If you see things like that, I really want you to think about a spinal epidural hematoma, right? Many people think that for some reason, the only place you can have epidural hematomas is in the brain. That is not true, right? Remember, you literally have those three meningeal coverings also in the spinal cord as well, right? One common complication of initiating anticoagulation therapy on MBME exams, especially when you see like back pain and neurodeficits, is a spinal epidural hematoma. Again, I know some of these things are not GI, but they are floridly high yield to know for your USML exams. So as they come up in my mind, I just figure it will make sense to go ahead and talk about them. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a 30-year-old female? You know, they tell you that she presents with a one-year history of like, you know, like chronic diarrhea, polydipsia, polyuria, right? And then over the last year, they say, oh, you know, she's noticed that her hat, her shoes, her rings, they don't fit, right? And then they tell you that, oh, her friends noticed that, man, she looks really different from the person they knew like a long time ago. If you see stuff like this, what should you be thinking about? I really hope that you're saying that, you know, this person potentially has MEN1 syndrome, right? This person potentially has MEN1 syndrome, right? So let's talk about some things here, right, that relates to gastroenterology, and also, you know, make a few integrations with other systems, right? So the first thing you should be thinking about, right, in terms of this person having chronic diarrhea, is you want to think about Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, right? You want to think about Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. Remember, Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, it really, 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 really loves to cause diarrhea, right? Many people don't realize this. All they think about is, ooh, divine, gastrin, you know, it increases your acid. Yes, don't get me wrong, gastrin will absolutely increase your acid, right? Because we know that gastrin will ultimately stimulate your parietal cells and to make acid, but it can also stimulate your enterochromaffin like cells, right, which will release histamine that will then go and act on the parietal cells to make acid, right? So it increases your acid. So, you know, you're going to have all these weird ulcers, like ulcers in the jejunum, right? Again, usually people have like peptic ulcers, right? Like either in the stomach or the duodenum. When you start seeing ulcers in the jejunum, that's pretty bizarre, right? Whenever you see stuff like that, person probably has something weird going on in their lives, right? Like, you know, like Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, right? But remember, the thing is, gastrin, though, remember, Gastrin is also a prokinetic agent, right? So the thing is, they can actually give you a Zollinger-Ellison syndrome question and the person has diarrhea as a finding, right? Remember, gastrin is a prokinetic agent. That's actually very high yield to know. Gastrin is a prokinetic agent, right? So the NBME, like, one thing they are very big on these days are giving you things that people don't really know. It's not that we don't understand. We actually do understand the pathophys, but people don't think of these things as causes of diarrhea. Remember, in Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, because gastrin is a prokinetic agent, people can get diarrhea as a result. In medullary thyroid cancer, calcitonin, right, causes you to secrete more electrolytes into the lumen of your GI tract. It can cause a secretory diarrhea. That can cause diarrhea, right? So just kind of keep those things in mind. Even botulism, right? They love to write botulism questions as diarrheal questions in kids on NBME exams. Again, it's something you absolutely need to watch out for. Right, so that's Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. And how do we treat ZE syndrome? Remember, we can treat it with a proton pump inhibitor, right? So that you can prevent the formation of acid, right? But now, some other things you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? With ZE syndrome, you may say, oh, which of the following will be the most likely finding on biopsy of the intestines, or I mean of the stomach? Well, I would really hope that you're telling me that there will be hyperplasia of the parietal cells, right? And the thing is, unfortunately, those things can actually predispose a person to having a gastric adenocarcinoma, right? Whenever you have this just constant inflammation because you're trying to fix one ulcer after the other, that can increase a person's risk of having like a maltoma, right? They can have a maltoma, but they can also have a gastric adenocarcinoma as a result of that. Now, you may say, okay, Divine, why does this person that have MEN1 have polyuria polydipsia? Well, the reason they have the polyuria polydipsia is because they have hypercalcemia, right? They have hypercalcemia. So you may be like, Divine, okay, hypercalcemia, polyuria polydipsia, how exactly does that work? Well, the thing that many people don't realize is that when you have high levels of calcium, it actually messes up your principal cell's response to ADH. Like, literally, hypercalcemia causes a nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. So remember, nephrogenic diabetes insipidus is not caused only by demeclocycline, is not caused only by lithium. It can also be caused by the electrolyte abnormality, hypercalcemia. This is why whenever you see an NBME question of people that have hypercalcemia, they usually show up with, like, making a ton of urine, drinking a ton of fluid, right? So they essentially have a nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, right? So that's why they can have hypernatremia, right? Again, they don't respond to ADH, right? That's why usually one of the best treatments for symptomatic hypercalcemia is go ahead and give the person fluid, because they're usually like profoundly volume down, right? And then just to kind of tee the rest of this up, right? Like, why is the person having their hats, their rings and stuff not fit? God, I really hope you're telling me that, oh, Divine, this person likely has an acromegaly, right? Remember, acromegaly, right? Yeah, over the age of 18, so it's going to be acromegaly because they have some kind of pituitary adenoma that's making a ton of growth hormone, right? So remember, when a person has a growth hormone excess, right, what is the smart thing you'd usually do? First thing you do is you check the IGF-1 levels, right? Again, they'll try to trick you into checking the growth hormone levels. Don't do that, right? That's usually not a smart idea, right? Go ahead and check the IGF-1 levels, because growth hormone is secreted it has like a lot of variations in its secretion. Sometimes during the day, it's really high. Sometimes during the day, it's really low. So if you catch it at the really low point, you may think like, oh, this person is fine. No, right? So that's why you check the IGF-1 levels first, right? That's going to be your screening test, right? And then after you notice that the IGF-1 is elevated, then the next thing you're going to do is you're going to do, after you do any screening test, it would make sense that you do some kind of confirmatory test, right? That's just biostats at play right there, right? So your confirmatory test will be like to give glucose and see if the person's growth hormone suppresses, right? That's the oral glucose suppression test, right? In general, if a person has failure of their growth hormone to suppress with glucose administration, then that's diagnostic of the person having acromegaly, right? Then obviously after that, you're going to go ahead and get an MRI of the brain so you can find the pituitary adenoma, right? And then you're going to fix it surgically, right? The buzzword you're looking for on an exam is a transsphenoidal resection, right? You're looking for a transsphenoidal resection, right? A transsphenoidal resection. Although they're also saying, oh, the person is a poor surgical candidate, what can you do? Well, again, a couple of things you can do for acromegaly. You can actually go ahead and give a octreotide, right? Somatostatin analog. Remember, somatostatin shuts down the release of many things, right? But if that doesn't cut it, right, you can also give pegvisomant. 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 Pegvisomant is a growth hormone receptor antagonist that can be used to treat acromegaly, right? So So again, I know this is a GI review, but I'm going to make lots and lots and lots of integrations, because the thing is, at the end of the day, the MBME is not linear, right? The MBME is more of an integral exam, right? So you want to be able to think in multiple dimensions from just one topic, right? So the GI topic actually did talk about here was Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, right? But you say again, I kind of talked about in the context of MEN1 syndrome, right? Okay, now, maybe the last thing we should talk about today, because again, I want to keep this under 30 minutes, and I have a quick life lesson I want to talk about, right? So what if you get a question about like a 29-year-old male, you know, his BMI 17, oh, okay, and then he looks malnourished, and then he tells you that, oh, whenever he eats, his abdominal pain feels worse, right? His abdominal pain feels worse. If he does not eat, his abdominal pain feels better. So if they eat, they feel bad. If they don't eat, they feel good, right? If you see this, I really want you to think about a gastric ulcer, right? Remember, whenever people have gastric ulcers, again, it's usually in the antrum, right? It can be caused by many things, right? It can be caused by H. pylori, right? It can be caused by NSAIDs. Remember, NSAIDs, right, by inhibiting cyclooxygenase, they'll kill your synthesis of prostaglandins. By killing your synthesis of prostaglandins, you're killing that protective effect of prostaglandins on your gastric mucosa, right? And then don't forget, right, burns, right? Whenever a person suffers a really bad burn, right, that's a Crohn's ulcer, or they have increased ICP, like a Cushing's ulcer, right, those things can all cause a gastric ulcers, right? And if I'm not mistaken, one of the reasons that those things may happen is you may have like a big parasympathetic drive, right? I remember your parasympathetic system through gastrin-releasing peptide makes you make a ton of gastrin, which can make you produce a ton of acid, right? So that's one potential mechanism right there, right? So I think let's go ahead and maybe talk about how you treat H. pylori, and then we'll wrap up here, right? So how do you treat H. pylori? Again, remember you can use a triple therapy, right? So triple therapy was the easy way to remember what it means, right? Remember the term CAP, C-E-P, right? So the C is for clarithromycin, the A is for amoxicillin, and the P is for a PPI, a proton pump inhibitor, right? But if that doesn't work, then you need to proceed to quadruple therapy, right? Quadruple therapy is like metronidazole, right, bismuth, subsalicylate, tetracycline, and then a PPI, right? Remember, metronidazole, don't take alcohol with it, right? Because remember, metronidazole has the ability to inhibit acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, right? So the person will have a buildup of acetaldehyde, and they can have a disulfurma side effect. So I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams. Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 2 CS. Well, that's now a defunct exam. But let's say Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 3. Preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, I need tutoring for your internal medicine in training exam or your medicine boards. I tutor for those things. Again, I've had many, many people be successful. And then, you know, if you need application advising for the ERAS process or for the MCAS process, again, I've had many successful students. If you have like a tricky application, lots of red flags, stuff like that, just reach out to me and I'll be happy to give you some more information on pricing and the kind of work I can do with you to really help you put your best foot forward. And then the next thing I would say is I do offer classes, especially for the Step 2 CK, Step 3 exams. And also an MBME test taking strategies class. I'm actually going to be holding one next month. Towards the end of next month, I'm going to be making a podcast on that and giving some more information on that. And then please subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com. If you're subscribed, then whenever I make a new podcast, you'll get an email notification. I also have a YouTube channel. That's where I put all my videos, Divine Intervention USMLE podcasts and videos. So please subscribe to that. That definitely always helps. And then I also have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. At least my most recent 150 podcasts are going to be on there. But if you want all the podcasts from episode 1 up to the present time, always check the website. That's where it's going to be. Divine Intervention Podcasts, again, with an S at the end, .com. And so what's my life lesson today? So my life lesson today is about something I call crossing the aisle. Crossing the aisle, right? I just kind of thought of it as a topic, right? Because an aisle is something that used to go from like one point to another, right? So what can crossing the aisle mean for many people, right? It can mean going from being poor to being rich, right? It can mean going from having some kind of bad behavior or some kind of addiction, right? Or some kind of mental health crisis to another, to, you know, being better. It can go from being lazy to being hardworking, right? It can go from being a failure to being a success, right? So today I'm going to talk about like two key things that can make you cross the aisle in life, right? So what's the first one? The first one I will say is just not being lazy, right? The thing is, many times people are very lazy. Again, I know you may be like, wow, in medicine, everyone in medicine is hardworking. That's actually not true, right? Again, and I can say this with a unique perspective because again, I've worked with thousands of students in my lifetime, right? Like I've seen lots of medical students, I've seen lots of residents, and I've seen lots of attendings that are lazy, right? So people are actually lazy, and that's the thing that is keeping them on the other end of the aisle, right? You see some people, they just don't want to work hard. You see them, they are very slow at their work. Again, folks, if you're lazy, it's going to be really hard for you to be successful in life, right? In fact, there is a part of the Bible that says that seest thou a man that is diligent in his business, he will stand before kings, not before mean men, right? So that's the thing. Go and learn from the ant, right? I love the book of Proverbs, has all these great teachings, right? Learn from the ant, you sluggard, stuff like that, right? So again, one way you can break out of, you can cross the aisle in life is really to not be lazy, right? Just make that change in your life. Start being hardworking. Start being diligent, right? Pay attention to your duties, right? Again, if you want to cross that aisle from, oh, I didn't do so well on step one, I want to crush it on step two, CK. To cross that aisle needs hard work, right? If you know you had poor study habits, change something. Do something different so you can move in the right direction. So that's the first thing that can prevent people from crossing the aisle, right? So if you're lazy, be hardworking and you can cross the aisle of life. Now, the second thing I want to talk about is giving excuses. Oh, people are very good at giving lots and lots and lots of excuses, right? People love giving excuses. What do I mean by that? They always give one excuse after the other. They talk about, my background makes it hard for me to achieve this thing in life. Or, because I have this kind of disposition, or because of these conditions that we are around. The thing is, I know we currently live in a time of life where, you know, sometimes people want to talk about how, in fact, I want to be careful here so I don't get myself in trouble. But people talk about some background they have that is making it impossible for them to reach certain heights, right? The thing I would say is, if you look and if you do your research, there are many people that have that background that you say is a disadvantage that have made great things of their lives in spite of those disadvantages. Don't get me wrong. Do people have cogent reasons for why they may have to work harder than normal to succeed? Absolutely, right? Like being in a certain background or being in a certain socioeconomic status or whatever can absolutely present some challenges to achieving certain things in your life. But the thing is, the fact that you have that background, right? There's this famous Nigerian musician that I love using this statement. He's a gospel musician. He says, don't let your background let you keep your back to the ground, right? Don't let your background let you keep your back to the ground, right? So you see many people, they give one reason after the other. Oh, I'm in this socioeconomic status. I'm in this, I'm in that, I'm in this, I'm in that, I'm in this, I'm in that. I'm being disenfranchised, blah, 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 blah. Again, don't get me wrong. Are those things good reasons? Yes, they are. But the thing is, you can overcome those reasons. You can rise above, right? So like, today, we really celebrate Martin Luther King because he rose above the circumstances that existed in his life back then. Again, I know some of what I'm saying is controversial. Again, my apologies. Again, I don't really mean to incense anyone or whatever, right? And I'm trying to be as wise as I can in what I'm saying right now. But even if you have, and again, like, let me preface this as again, challenges are unfortunate, right? The fact that a person, obviously, if you have fewer challenges, you may be able to move really far in life. But the thing is, I will challenge you to try to maybe change that mindset that that those challenges are keeping you down. Or because I feel like many people just use that as an excuse, right? Again, look at Kamala Harris, right? The current vice president of the US. Hey, she doesn't necessarily belong in, she's not necessarily in the majority, right? She's a person that you may say, oh, belongs to a minority population. But guess what? She's kind of broken through all those barriers, right? And now she's the vice president, right? So the thing is, don't let your background be an excuse, right? Don't let your background be an excuse, right? Don't let your background be an excuse. Rise above that background. Again, the fact that you have a certain kind of background does not mean that because of that background, you have a defined kind of future. No, right? You can have a background that presents gives you many good reasons, right, for why you cannot succeed. But the thing is, you can be a trailblazer. To be honest with you, again, I'm not a Portland Trailblazers fan, but I really love the name of their team, Portland Trailblazers, right? You can be a trailblazer. You can be the first person that has had all these challenges and broke through to succeed, right? So that's the thing. Like, I know many people that are minority populations that have succeeded, right? So I will encourage you as individuals. Again, I don't mean to incense anyone. I'm just saying this from a place of love, but really, really try your life. Stop giving excuses, right? Stop giving excuses. There are many people that have been through much tougher circumstances, right? Much tougher circumstances that have achieved much bigger things, right? Much bigger things, right? Because I just feel like we live in a generation now where people always try to find a reason for why they are down. Find a reason. Instead of finding reasons, why don't you go ahead and find solutions, right? Because, like, for example, there's even this part of the Bible that says you have not yet, in your struggle against sin, you've not yet struggled to the point of shedding your blood, right? Like, literally, like, there are people that have shed their blood because they are trying to do the right thing, right? You are not being, and in some countries of the world, people have had to do that. But the thing is, let's say, for example, you live in a country like America, for example, right? You have all these advantages, right? Stop giving excuses. Because I can tell you, if you go to other parts of the world, there are people that are going through some very tortuous, very tenuous circumstances, and they are still making headway in life, right? They are still making headway. I mean, like, just take, for example, from my own personal life experience, right? Probably sharing more than I intended to hear. But from my own personal life experience, I remember back home in Nigeria when I was a kid, we would have exams and all that stuff, you know, where, you know, like here in the US, you know, you get like a syllabus before you take an exam. In Nigeria then, we actually did not have like a syllabus. So we, at least the school I went to, we didn't really know when we would have most of our exams. Most of our exams were completely impromptu, right? So we would have to be in situations where we would, like an instructor could walk into the class and say, oh, write your name, write your class, tear a sheet of paper, we have an exam, right? So the thing is, if I'd given that excuse of, wow, oh, I didn't know that the exam was today, I would have failed, right? I would have failed many exams, but, you know, thank God, I did pretty well for the most part, right? And that was because I was always prepared, right? Or I could have given the excuse that, man, I don't have electricity at home, right? Because, I mean, there were times in Nigeria where I went months without electricity, right? Electricity is something that in the US, everyone enjoys without thinking twice about it, right? So it's like, but in those circumstances, I'm like, oh, divine, go ahead and turn on the candle. Go ahead and turn on the kerosene lamp, right? To study, right? So I didn't give all those excuses that, oh, humble background, there's no electricity, there's no water, there's no this, there's no that. So stop giving excuses for why you're not succeeding, right? Again, don't let your background put your back to the ground. You can succeed. You can blaze trails. You can move forward, right? If you put in the requisite effort. And, you know, if you have God on your side, right? So again, put in the work, right? Again, from listening to my podcast, you probably know that I'm a man of faith. But the thing is, you can really make headway in life. Again, for me, my faith is something that's very important to me, but you also need to put in the hard work and stop giving excuses, stop being lazy, and you can succeed. So thank you for listening to this life lesson. I will see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.